and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters I find therein, about their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. This episode is a very special episode of Monster Man. This is episode number 50. When you count the specials and the zero episode and so on, that means I've been doing this for about half a year. Which is pretty amazing when you consider that this is an idea that I had in my sleep, basically. I woke up one morning and I thought, you know what I should do is I should do a show in which I read the Monster Manual and it should be called Monster Man. And it all just kind of went from there. Thank you all so much for listening as this show has grown and developed, and for supporting it. And speaking of supporting it, before we do anything else in today's special, it's time to thank a new patron. Yes, this is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like this patron, you pledge at the $2 level or higher, you'll also get access to my new show, Patron Deities, which is about the Deities and Demigods supplement, and really uses it as a springboard to learn more about world mythology. I think it's a lot of fun. So thank you very much to Richard August for supporting the show. Alright, so we're going to do a couple of things in today's special episode. We are going to talk about some monsters, because, you know, that's how this show works. We're going to do the entirety of the Q chapter, which is to say, the entry for one monster, the Quasit. But we're going to start with a look through the old monster mailbag. I asked listeners to write in with their questions, suggestions, comments, whatever, and we're going to read them and respond to them. I mean, I'm not just going to read people's questions and then leave them hanging. That'd be weird. So some people wrote in with just, compliments and expressions of support, for which I am very, very grateful. It's wonderful to know that people are enjoying the show. And some people wrote in with questions. So let's take a look at some of those. My first question comes from listener Jason, who writes, "Hi, James. Thanks for doing the podcast. I've been listening along with my son, also named James, who is a 6-year-old kindergartner and is just starting to get into D&D. James has a question for your mailbag episode. Are there any monsters that look like trees? Hi, James. Good name. That's a good question. In fact, there are a couple of different monsters that look like trees, although there are not very many in the Monster Manual. But let's take a look at some of the ones that are. Now, way, way, way back early on in the show, I talked about a monster called the Dryad. Now, dryads in the Monster Manual just kind of look like people. But in the stories that they come from, they sometimes can turn into trees, or maybe they look a little bit like trees. They're kind of forest spirits, and it's not very clear exactly what they look like. So in the Monster Manual, the artist seems to have decided that they pretty much just look like people, but there are lots of other versions of dryads that are more tree-like. So, for example, they might have leaves instead of hair, or they might have skin that looks a little like bark. So dryads are spirits, but they can look a little bit like trees. The most tree-like monster in the Monster Manual is called the Tree Ant, and it's basically like a huge walking tree. Even the smallest of them are 12 to 15 feet high. Now, the Tree Ant is based on a creature called the Ent, and Ents appear in the Lord of the Rings books by J.R.R. Tolkien. In those books, it doesn't necessarily say that they really look like trees. In Old English, which is what English sounded like 1,000 years ago, Ent just means giant, and Tolkien, who knew that language, decided to use the word for his giant creatures. But he also describes them as looking a little bit like trees. And in Dungeons & Dragons, they become much more tree-like, so they're really just huge walking trees with branches for arms. And because they're so big, if you take a look at a big oak tree, I mean, think about how big and powerful it would be if it could move around. Well, that's what a tree ant is like, and they can be quite dangerous if they're upset. Now, of course, the Monster Manual isn't the only place that you can find Dungeons & Dragons monsters. There are lots of different books put out over the years, and some of those include tree monsters as well. One example of those is the Blight. And these turn up in later editions of D&D. So, for example, if you look at the modern Monster Manual, not the old one that I'm using from when I was little, these are trees that have been turned into people or have been turned into monsters. And that started when someone drove a stake through the heart of a vampire, and the vampire's blood got into the wood, and then the wood began to grow into a tree, and then the tree began to corrupt these other trees and turn them into monsters. So they are monsters, and they have kind of like tree-like powers. So, for example, there's one that has sort of a pine tree-like appearance, and of course, like a pine tree, it's got lots of little needles, and then it can attack you with its needles. And there are lots of tree-like monsters in myths and legends from all around the world. So, for example, in Japan, there's a tree spirit called the Kodama. And the Kodama just looks like a normal tree, but the people say it moves around. So they sort of, like, dance around the hills, and then, you know, the next morning the tree will be in a different place. And if you cut a Kodama down, then you could get a curse. And there's a fictional monster called a Juboko that's kind of based on the Kodama. And what it is it's a tree that grows where there was once a battlefield. And so its roots stretch down into the soil, you know, that soaked up so much blood during the battle. And then it becomes hungry for more. So it's like a vampire tree. And if someone gets too close to it, it'll grab them. And of course, a famous example of a tree monster comes from The Wizard of Oz. So in the Oz books, there's what's called the Forest of Fighting Trees. And these are, you know, trees that will try and grab you with their branches. And in the movie The Wizard of Oz, the main character plucks an apple off of one of these trees, and then they get angry because, you know, they don't like to have their apples plucked without permission, and so they attack by throwing apples. Which doesn't sound so bad, but I don't know. I think a reasonable-sized apple could actually really hurt if someone threw it at you, so don't throw apples at anybody. Anyway, James, thank you very much for listening to Monster Man, and I hope that answered your question about tree monsters. Okay, our next message comes from listener Neil. Neil just wanted me to talk about Modrons. Now, there's a lot of Modrons, and I'm not gonna actually discuss them here, but I did want to, like, springboard off Neil's question and talk about my plans for the Monster Manual 2. Because as you can tell from the fact that we're doing a Q monster in this episode, there's a lot of good R and S monsters, but there's not a whole lot in the back half of the alphabet. You know, the last, once we get through the Zorn and the Yeti and the Zombie, I mean, that's pretty much it. So my plan is to take a little bit of a break between sort of what you might call Season 1 and Season 2. And I don't mean that there aren't going to be new Monster Man episodes, because there are, but I'm not going to do any one thing. I'm going to look at Creatures from Dragon Magazine, or I'm going to look at monsters from other RPGs. Like, I might do an episode or two on monsters in the World of Cinnabar, or I might talk about monsters in other media. Like, I might talk about the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon, or things like that. Like, I'm just going to do a couple of short, kind of one or two off little special subjects, and then we're going to move on to the next subject. And that's probably not going to be the Monster Manual 2. It's probably going to be the Fiend Folio. If everyone doesn't want me to do the Fiend Folio and everybody wants to do the Monster Manual 2, then I might consider changing my mind. But I feel like the Fiend Folio will be a really interesting change of pace for a number of reasons that I'll discuss when I get around to talking about it. So I guess the short answer is we are going to do a whole thing on Modrons. I love Modrons, don't you? But I think that we will see them in the Monster Manual 2, and they will clearly have captured the reader's imagination somehow, because they go on to become popular, which is more than you can say for a lot of monsters in the Monster Manual 2. But at the same time, did they come there from another source? I genuinely don't know the sort of origins of Monster Manual 2 yet, but I really think that Modrons don't kind of come into their own until you get Tony DiTerlizzi drawing them. And then I think Modrons become lovable, which is how most of us feel about them. Either that or it's a Planescape Torment thing. I don't know. I didn't play that game. So, Neil, I just wanted you to know I have not forgotten, and we will be doing Modrons. My next point, and this is not really a question, but I think it's a really interesting point to raise, comes from listener Mookie McMook. Mookie says, and this is in reference to the Ogre episode, in which we talked about the Ogre and the Ogre Mage. And Mookie writes, "Something you skirted around but didn't quite say. The terrible things about Ogres and Oni is that they're wild men, capital W, capital M. Everything they do is a manifestation of human vice writ large. So there's a certain element of what we would become if our discipline wavered. In the case of the Japanese ogre, there are Japanese folktales about particularly brutal, greedy, gluttonous, and wicked humans becoming Oni, either after death or while they still live, which explicitly makes them part of a cautionary tale against barbarism. Ogres of both varieties, and hill giants while we're at it, are easy and fun to wrap your head around. Picture a typical thuggish vice-ridden human, then dial their self-control all the way down, and their size and strength up proportionally. An ogre's likely to walk into town, bat the militia aside on the way to the tavern, bash a hole in the wall, and attempt to make off with an entire keg of ale. This makes them an appropriate monster for all levels. For a low-level party, there's two ogre brothers that come trundling down from the hills every so often to grab entire sheep and occasional shepherds. For a mid-level party, there's the ogre mage who's starting to put together a warband and go pillaging. At a high level, ogres are still around as mercenaries or slaves to greater evils, such as a full-bore fire giant army. Bonus point, all ogres are as greedy as they are gluttonous, but they don't need money for anything. They just like shinies, which means an established ogre lair or oni fortress is probably stuffed with loot. Yeah, that seems to be a really characteristic thing about fairy tale monsters, doesn't it? That they, you know, they're always amassing gold, but they never spend it on anything. You know, someone said that fairy tales are about how adults see children and how children see adults. Fairies are whimsical and capricious and do stuff that doesn't make any sense and are completely driven by their impulses and never think. Or fairies are creatures that assign you seemingly meaningless tasks with seemingly meaningless punishment and rewards, you know, which must be how children see adults. And I wonder if children see the adult preoccupation with money as, you know, some kind of bizarre fixation, since they don't really understand how important it is. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right about ogres, that they are essentially caricatures, right? They're very exaggeratedly human-like. It's the same with giants, except that giants don't necessarily have the connotation of being bad. So giants are just interesting because they're extremely large, right? Size is what matters about a giant. We had that thing about it's, you know, excellent to have a giant's strength, but it's tyrannous to use it like a giant. But just think about what happens when you, I mean, you, if you call somebody a giant, it's usually a compliment, right? She's a giant in her field. Whereas if you call somebody an ogre, it's really not. Or a troll, for that matter. But it's also interesting that ogres have money and stuff like that, right? They're not, I mean, I think barbarism is the wrong term here. Just because I don't feel like ogres are, if you look at art of ogres, they're often depicted in sort of furs and rags, but they're also often depicted in normal human clothes. I think this is a sort of idea that ogres almost are part of a community in a way that giants are alien to it. I don't know. They're not quite outsiders. They're insiders who've become outsiders. Now, I've referred to Glorantha a few times on this show. Glorantha is the fantasy setting that is the basis for games like RuneQuest and HeroQuest. And now there's a new 13th age in Glorantha. And for the video game, The King of Dragon Pass, which incidentally is really great. And in Glorantha, you become an ogre by eating people. It's a thing that happens to you if you engage in cannibalism. You eventually become an ogre. And that sounds like that story of, you know, particularly barbarous humans, ones who violate some important taboo, ultimately becoming ogres. Ogres are kind of underrated because they're usually seen as kind of a, like, either a bigger orc or kind of an inferior giant. And I think there's actually more you can do with them. And this is a really good point. Okay, my next message comes from listener Stan, and it's about mummies. Now, I've got some really good comments on the mummy episode, but here's a thing that Stan noticed. Stan writes, one point about the mummy that I've always found interesting. In the Monster Manual, they're described as being linked to the positive material plane. Other undead are described as linked to the negative material plane, if anything. Perhaps this points to the means of creation of mummies as more licit than the means of creating undead with negative material connections. The other sorts of undead often come about because of necromantic magic or people not being buried properly. Mummies, though, are buried properly. Perhaps exceptionally so. It's a small point, but does serve to point out that at this point in the game's history, the positive energy plane is not entirely associated with good. The mummy is evil, of course, and presumably they didn't start that way, but perhaps being recalled from the great beyond to reanimate their body and smash some tomb robbers make them less than friendly, or maybe insane. In light of all of this, it might seem odd that mummies can be turned by clerics, but this description predates the idea that the power of clerics over undead is necessarily linked to channeling energy of some sort. Now, I think this is a really interesting point. I've got to be completely frank. I never really paid a whole lot of attention to the planar cosmology of Dungeons & Dragons. It doesn't come up a lot in the games that I run, and I never really played Planescape, which I think is the place where it becomes really vital. And I think that a lot of people who, you know, think a lot about planar cosmology are big Planescape fans. But this does tie into something else I was saying about mummies, which is that, as Stan points out, mummies aren't necessarily bad guys, or at least not completely bad guys. The people that the mummy is chasing, usually, according to the mummy's sense of right and wrong, have it coming. They have violated its tomb. It said on the door, don't come in here, and yet they came in. What do you want? So the mummy is a response to a violation of the rules. But that response to a violation is itself a violation, which might explain why clerics can still turn them. Now, the cleric's job is to restore the natural order. And again, traditionally, the hero of a mummy, the protagonist of a mummy film, is either not the person who awakened it in the first place, or learns his or her lesson. So I think that's an interesting point about mummies, and I think I am reminded that, you know, I see conversations in, you know, old school discussion groups about plain stuff, and I usually just scroll past. But maybe I should pay more attention. All right, next message comes from listener Goblin's Henchman, and this is about owlbears and umber hulks, and this comes from the Owlbear special, in which I talked about the evolving appearance of the owlbear, how the images of D&D monsters have evolved over editions. And Henchman writes, "The owlbear has become less of a chinosaur and really a mixture of an owl and bear. The umber hulk to me is more interesting. The 5e version looks nothing like the humanoid-like creature in Monster Manual 1 and more like some sort of insect praying mantis. I'm not sure how this happened. I prefer the beetle-headed hulking humanoid." It's interesting, isn't it? Both the owlbear and the umber hulk have moved toward visual depictions that have more kind of natural elements to them. So the new umber hulk looks like, yeah, as you say, a praying mantis or a giant beetle. And that seems to come from the fact that there are beetle-like qualities to the original umber hulk, right? It has those kind of beetle mandibles. It has the faceted eyes like an insect. And similarly, the owlbear's name suggests that it's part owl, part bear, which is not what its art looks like at all. Meanwhile, there are some D&D monsters whose appearances have stayed almost exactly the same. Bugbears look much like they originally did. They've become a little more kind of ferocious. Gnolls, again, more or less the same. They just got, you know, they got bigger and buffer. You know, the 90s Image Comics revolution happened to them too. And Mind Flayers look almost exactly the same, although some people don't remember that Mind Flayers only have four tentacles. Drow look pretty much the same as well. Now, maybe that's just an example of some of these monsters are instant design classics where there's nothing to change. In other cases, I gave one example, and I don't even remember what it was. It's back in the M section. It was another aquatic monster that it just doesn't look, and it just constantly changes. Like, not only does it, you can see how the modern Umber Hulk evolved from the old one, you know, becoming more insectoid over time. But there are other cases where the original design just didn't stick. Like, it didn't land, there was nothing particularly special about it, and it's just changed completely. And then there are ones where they hit permanently. I think it's really important, you know, for a game that doesn't necessarily have a real visual component. I mean, you don't really hold up pictures to show people during games, or at least I don't. Although I do use miniatures, so, you know, but lots of people don't do either. So for a game that doesn't in play use its illustrations, illustrations are very important to Dungeons & Dragons and to the Monster Manual. I really wish I could include more visual stuff in this podcast, since a lot of the time what I'm talking about is what something looks like. Huh. So, I mean, it's interesting to see which of these monsters hit and which don't, and I don't know that there's necessarily a pattern. My next question comes from listener Christopher. It's actually a couple of questions. So, Christopher writes, "I enjoy the fact that most episodes fly in under 15 minutes, bite-sized chunks that don't wear out their welcome, and a breezy way to pass the time. Well, Christopher, I apologize for this special. I think you should have Allison on again, or other guests. Sometimes a second voice and opinion can be a breath of fresh air." Yeah, that's a comment that I've had from others as well. Here's the thing, though, and Allison will return, but I can't say when exactly. I certainly want to have Allison back, and I want to have other guests and co-hosts. The thing of it is, the reason that these episodes are so short, and the reason that it's usually just me, is that I wanted to create a podcast that I didn't have to work too hard to schedule. It doesn't seem like a lot, because the episodes are pretty short, but to put out two episodes a week, especially now that I've kind of run through a lot of my backlog, can be a bit of a challenge, and it only works because it's a show that I can record any time that I have a spare, like, 20 minutes. I mean, it takes a little while to do the editing, but I've got the workflow down. I feel like I can turn an episode of Monster Man around pretty quickly. I used to have a podcast. I mean, I still do have a podcast, and new episodes will be coming. But my first podcast is a show called Pledge Break, which is about Doctor Who. And I co-hosted it with my friend Jesse Merlin. And I think we did really good work, but we don't live near each other, and we're separated by a time difference. Jesse lives in the U.S. So scheduling a time for us to both be available to record these long episodes, they're an hour or more sometimes, and then for me to edit them, very challenging and time-consuming. And so our release schedule went all to heck, basically, because we simply didn't have the available time. So to avoid that, I wanted to make Monster Man as light as possible so that I could do it frequently. And it's worked out okay in that sense, but that's also why things that require more scheduling don't happen as regularly. Anyway, the monster question is, what's your favorite mook monster? Goblin, kobold, orc, gnoll, and how do you make them interesting rather than another eye-rolling goblins again encounter? Okay, so that's a two-part question. First, what's my favorite mook monster? There are two answers. One is bugbears. Just because they're big, rowdy, old, hairy old bugbears and I like them. I don't have any more justification for it than that. They're just big, dumb, hairy doofuses, and I'm very fond of them. The runner-up is bullywugs from the Fiendfolio. And there is no reason for that other than that I just like to say the name. Bullywug, bullywug, bullywug. It's fun. It sounds a little bit like, have you ever read the Walt Simonson run on The Mighty Thor? Which, if you haven't, you ought to, because it's superb. But there's that bit where Thor gets turned into a frog and he has all these adventures with the frogs of Central Park in New York. And they all have names like Puddle Gulp and whatever. And they just kind of sound like things frogs might say. So that's the Bullywug. Sounds like something a frog might say. And they're frogmen. It works. Bullywug. It's just fun. As for how you make them memorable, I mean, I think there are two ways, right? The first is, you wouldn't have a fight with people and go, oh, people again. Well, you might. But normally you wouldn't, and that's because those people would be given distinct kind of characters and personalities. And it's the same with grub non-unique monsters. Essentially, if you're only ever going to fight one tree ant, then you can let its tree antness do a lot of the characterization work for you, because it's the tree ant you're going to fight. Strahd von Zarovich is the least characterized person to ever have so much written about his character, because his character is Dracula. He's Dracula, okay. And that's perfect. He should be Dracula, okay, because he's the Lord of the Vampires, and the Lord of the Vampires is going to be Dracula. You're not going to fight Dracula twice. I mean, that's a path of diminishing returns. So when you fight Dracula, you want that bad boy to be Dracula. But with recurring monsters, whether that's animals or, you know, goblins or whatever, you need to put a little more effort into them. And that's okay, that effort's going to be rewarded because you're going to use them more often, right? It's not efficient to super characterize something you're only going to fight once, but if somebody's going to turn up a lot, you need to think a little bit about what's their organization, their motivation, like who are the characters, and you want to subvert the expectations as well. You know, with something like goblins, they're so much a part of our cultural consciousness that you don't have to do much work to provide the stuff that everybody expects. And there's a fantastic blog post on a blog called Against the Wicked City, which is really worth reading, in which he was talking about how many printed adventures spend a lot of time telling you stuff you already knew, right? Like giving detailed characterization to a tribe of orcs, which only tell you in a lot of words that they are violent savages, which is what you knew already because they're orcs. So you need to give them a little bit of a twist. And a twist that can be revealed over time, right? So you need to be able to fight them and then learn something. Whether that's just that, oh, these are merely the scouts for a larger, you know, army on the march, or they've been pushed out of their home because it's got a displacer beast in it, or, you know, whatever. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to make them humanized or sympathetic, but you need to give them a little bit more complexity. The third is that if you don't want to change the monster, you have to change the context. A fight against goblins who are springing an ambush in the nacreous pits of their cave complex, and a fight against goblins who are marauding along the coastline in their crude rafts, jumping onto ships and burning them, can be very different, even if the goblins are pretty much the same. So a lot of it is just about changing the environment. There is nothing more poisonous to excitement in Dungeons & Dragons fights, in my view, than fights always taking place in basically a big room. I mean, you just have to think about how writers in any genre make fighting the same guys interesting. You know, when you're watching a show, I don't know, when you're watching, let's say, I don't know if you guys watch Arrow, but there's a lot of that in it. There's a lot of, ugh, ninjas again, he's just fighting ninjas. Yeah, because it's the same fight every time, it's just a bunch of kicking and arrow shooting. But if you go and watch a bunch of classic Shaw Brothers movies or something, most of the time you're not going, ugh, kung fu guys again. So think about what the differences are in terms of how those fights are presented. Anyway, that would be my advice. Okay, my next question is from Ian, who asks, what is your favorite setting-specific monster? And he gives the example of the corpse collectors from Eberron. This is a tough one. I actually don't know that much about D&D settings that have a lot of distinctive monsters in them. So I'm sure there are a lot of creatures that someone who knew more about published D&D settings could tell me, well, oh no, this is actually a setting-specific monster to the Forgotten Realms, or this is actually a setting-specific monster for Greyhawk. So, like, I guess I never really got into Dragonlance, but I guess in Dragonlance, Minotaurs are something different from Minotaurs in other games and whatever. But ultimately, I feel like it's pretty much the case that things are quite interchangeable, and I don't really use published settings. So I haven't really looked into them in a great deal of detail. So, like, Eberron seems like fun. The idea is pretty much just like steampunk D&D, but I've never read an Eberron book. It seems to me that settings that are successful ultimately kind of make their way back into the core game, and whatever that is, right? So I'm sure there are things that I use in my games that are not just generic fantasy tropes, but specifically elements of the Forgotten Realms or of Greyhawk or of whatever, but I don't really pay attention to that kind of thing. And I love world building. I consider it more of an aesthetic process than a simulation one, but I'm probably not going to use a published fantasy setting if it's not the best fantasy setting, Glorantha. So yeah, I don't really have a good answer to that question. Okay, so I think that's it for the listener mailbag. Now, you'll have noticed that the listener mailbag feature kind of went away on the show itself over the last few episodes, and that's because I've been saving them for this special. But if you have questions or comments, or if I forgot yours, I made a pretty slapdash list for this special episode, so if I left yours out, just let me know. The contact information is at the end of this episode. Before we go today, though, let's push on through the Monster Manual, and let's talk about the Quazzet, the only monster in the Q section of the Monster Manual. What is a Quazzet? Well, what I want you to do is go back and, you know, scroll through the old Monster Man feed until you come to episode 30, Imp to Ishichachitl. Because a Quazzet is basically just an imp. The only difference being that imps are lawful, but Quazzets are chaotic. So while imps are devils, Quazzets are demons. And I think there's a bit in there where I complain about how imps can't turn into toads, but that's cool because Quazzets can. So I guess if you want your familiar to be a toad, you should be chaotic evil instead of lawful evil, like the local witch. In later editions, you'll be pleased to hear Quazzets are just listed under imps or demons. But here, they're just kind of, they're basically like imps, but for people who are, a little wilder. And their job is to go and corrupt souls, you know, like one does. In terms of their threat, Quazzets don't do an enormous amount of damage. D2 and D4 kind of attacks. But what they do is they put a dexterity penalty on you if they hit you, or at least they can. They can use fear. They're basically there to kind of complicate fights with their master, I think. And of course, to be their master's agent. And they have powers that are good for getting away, like, for example, invisibility. So a Quazzet might get sent out by an evil wizard to spy on his enemies or something like that. They're pretty okay. I mean, I really do like Dave Sutherland's illustration here, which gives the Quazzet a really loathsome appearance. Whereas the imp illustration is much more traditional, like, you know, you might find in, you know, an early modern manuscript, right? This kind of cackling imp. The Quazzet really looks horrible. And it says something about the mental state of someone who summons a Quazzet, right? Like, who is the kind of person that summons this horrible-looking thing with its weird, disky horns and its kind of melty-looking face and goes, oh yeah, this is going absolutely according to plan. This is what appeared in my summoning circle? Excellent. Completed stage one. That's a position where most people would start re-examining their life choices. But, I mean, once you're summoning Quazzets, I guess you're all in. So yeah, I mean, I don't think there's that much to say about Quazzets. They're basically just imps. They're fine. I mean, like imps, they're good. It's fun to have an additional kind of henchman for your evil wizard who isn't just another cultist, who has some interesting abilities, and who is very much in keeping with what we expect from evil wizards, right? The idea that they have an animal familiar who's some kind of sinister animal. And that includes a giant centipede, which is a pretty great evil familiar, right? If you've got this wizard in his long robes and then like a centipede comes scurrying out of his sleeves, like that's really good, especially if he has a bunch of them. I mean, I guess there's no reason that you couldn't have more than one Quasit familiar, right? So he could actually have like a swarm of these things scuttling all over him. That'd be horrible. Speaking of the Shaw brothers. So Quasits are pretty good. They're a useful, colorful monster. They don't have a huge amount of distinct identity, but they fit well into a bunch of already understood narrative roles. I don't know where the name comes from, though. It's not based on anything, as far as I can tell, but I could be wrong about that. All right, that's it for episode 50. Thank you all so much for listening and for enjoying and supporting the show. I hope to be with you for 50 more, and indeed 50 more after that, because there's a lot of monsters out there, and we got plenty more to talk about. Join me next time as we talk about the Rakshasa and also some rats and stuff on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.
Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.